You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Tatiana Tolstoya carries a daunting literary legacy, but instead of writing massive novels like her great-granduncle Leo Tolstoy, Ms. Tolstoya has been something of an intimist. She's one of Russia's most respected short story writers and essayists, and the author of an apocalyptic novel, but not an immense one. And now a comprehensive collection of her stories called White Walls and that novel, The Slinks, have been released in English language paperback editions by the New York Review of Books. And I'm very pleased that they bring Tatiana Tolstoya back to my show today. Hello.
Hello.
So many of your relatives have been successful writers. Your grandfather was the novelist Alexei Tolstoy. Your other grandfather was a respected literary translator. Your grandmother was an influential poet. Your father was a scholar. Your sister, Natalia Tolstoya, has become a writer too. Was it almost assumed in your family that you would become a writer?
Maybe in a way, because my father, for some reason, believed that I should become a writer, and I rejected the very idea and didn't even want to discuss that. But then one day I sat down, took a pen, and became a writer in a way. So this is it. He saw through things, maybe my father, because he didn't want other children, and there are seven children in the family. He didn't want them to become writers. He wanted me to become writers.
So he must have seen something in you. But there's I'm not sure whether it's genetic or whether growing up in an environment where people write makes it easier to write because you also understand that what that involves.
But it also makes it more difficult because then you have high standards. And you don't want even to start because you become shy. And you see, well, I will never be able even to do that.
Well, how can anybody compare him or herself to Leo Tolstoy?
No, that's absolutely
that's a burden.
Far beyond the reach. But also my grandfather, Alexei Tolstoy, he was a very good writer. And it's amazing. He was a modern writer in a way. So it's even makes it more difficult because he wrote in the 20th century and the syntax is different and the approach to things is different. And, well, the healthy cynicism, so to say, is present. So you have to match that, too. Because, you know, writing a 19th century novel, a mediocre 19th century novel, is easy. But now, I mean.
Mm-hmm. Because they worked it all out for us.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And there are lots of writers who are very, poor writers, but it still makes their writing interesting because they write about events, people gone.
But Alexei was also writing during the period of transition into communism, and so there that really inspired a lot of exciting literature.
It's not exactly the transition because he left the country. My grandfather, he left the country in 1919.
Mm-hmm,
He was not political at all. No. He just he struggled for a living and for a place in the, well, let's say writers' community, though it's not exactly so. He wanted to be a well-known writer, and he was not sure even about his talent because he, until he was 20-something, he only wrote poetry and not of very good quality. He tried to find his own voice. And then, well, here it is. They started shooting. It was 1917, and he, as my grandfather told us, he didn't know what is going on. He was irritated by the fact that they're shooting in the streets because he wants, some quiet sitting down and writing. And one day when the servant, the woman who bought things for them and looked for children, she went to the shop and said, "There is nothing there to buy." He said, "What does it mean, nothing? Buy some sausages and so on." She said, "But I mean nothing at all." So then they put their things together and they went south just in order to let these things pass. And they didn't want to emigrate. No one knew what was going on. No one wanted to emigrate, but they had to. They lived there for a year or so, and then they had to emigrate together with other Russian writers. But he came back 4 years later because he couldn't survive in Europe. At that time, it was a hard time in Europe, too.
Now, you talked about how language changed from the 19th to the 20th century. As I understand it, your son is a well-known web designer Russia. Mm-hmm. So now we're talking 21st century. Is it true that he once asked you not to talk publicly about being related to him because he didn't want the burden of the legacy?
Sure. At the beginning of his career, he wanted to be a person in his own right. He didn't want my name, which is not only my name. My name is okay, but this is the name of this family of Leo Tolstoy. So it calls for attention. So he didn't want to grow in the shadow of this great name. So he wanted to make his own name, because his name, of course, is different because he has his father's name. Yeah. And I absolutely understood him, because the name was something that really disturbed me.
Now, the New York Review of Books has been publishing a lot of worthy literature that kind of fell out of publication. There were a lot of out-of-print things. In the case of the short stories, the collection of short stories, White Walls, they have taken stories from two collections, haven't they, and put them together?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Did you choose these stories?
No, they did it on their own, and that's the way it should be, because I have a different approach to them. I see other things in these stories than they do, and they know better what to choose for the American readers.
Well, when you look back at your early stories, you probably see something different. You often see things, you say, oh, boy, I shouldn't have done that, or you might also say, wow, that was a lot better than I remembered.
Sure, both things. It works both ways. And also, I often have to look at these stories from the point of view of some foreigner, because my books are translated in several languages, and so I never know what is interesting for these or those people. For Japanese, for example, how to translate something.
What about translating into English? Does Russian translate easily into English? Because I've had some Russians tell me that Shakespeare is greater in Russian than he is in English.
Well, that's so much, of course. But Russian language is very, very good, very rich for the purpose of translating into Russian. But the other way around is not that easy. I would say that it's easier to translate Russian texts into German than into English. The two languages are too different. For example, in Russian, there are lots of suffixes that show all kinds of things, and mostly they show the diminutives. It's the whole range of different diminutives, which makes the attitude of someone who is speaking richer in details. In English, you can do nothing about it. So you have to go around. You have to choose some other way of expressing the same thing. I believe that you can express everything in the same way in all languages. But when languages are so different as Russian and English, you have to use different language devices. And a good translator is someone who doesn't translate directly and who knows how to reconstruct the feeling, the situation, the attitude, and so on, using other devices, not word-by-word translation. And I'm happy to have a very good translator, Jamie Gumbrell, and she works with me for already lots of years, I would say close to 17 years or something.
Well, actually, you have two translators in short stories. The other one was Antonia W. Bowie, I guess.
Yes, that's true, but
it your decision to switch translators?
No, it was not mine. In the very beginning, and the very beginning was before 1988, I guess. Before 1988. I had an idea. I had a translator. I had an idea who can translate my books, and I wanted the publisher at that time, Knopf Publishing House, to choose that very translator. But they made another choice without consulting me, and actually without having my opinion at all. And living in Russia, Soviet Union at that time, and them being here in the United States, there was hardly any contact. So I was furious about their choice and about the fact that they didn't even ask me.
And were you already as conversant in English then as you are now?
No.
You've lived here in the interim.
Yes, sure. I lived here for about 10 years. No, but I could explain everything. I could talk, and I understood everything. And after all, there are other ways, not the direct contact, but you can use someone as a translator. No, that was the attitude, as if I am, you know...
You had no say in the matter.
Yes, absolutely. But this about is my your own text. Story. Yeah, exactly.
And I'm sure that there are some complicated ideas that are the hardest thing to translate, and it would be good to be able to talk to a translator and explain what you're trying to say that is a lot clearer in Russian than it might be in a direct English translation.
True, but first of all, the translation should be an exact translation. If I use a word, you shouldn't change it for another word.
Well, the reason I bring that up is your great-granduncle's, I think it was Anna Karenina, was translated not so long ago in this country by a couple. She's Russian and he is American.
Yes,
and they came here and they talked about how they argued over things constantly because he had certain ideas of how it would sound best in English and she had certain things about remaining faithful to the text, and they had to wind up compromising all the time.
I see, yes. That must be very difficult, really, because it is a difficult text deeply inside. On the surface, it's an easy text, you know. Anna Karenina, but deeply inside, it is a complicated text because the author Leo Tolstoy, he has his own ideology, which sometimes we cannot accept, and we even become irritated by the fact that he has this ideology, and we want to, you know, to take it away from his text,
make it
which
nicer,
which is a madness, of course.
Now, when did you start publishing in the New Yorker?
Oh, long
after you'd
ago.
Come here or before?
Yes, no, after I came here. It was impossible, you know, after, before 90s, it was, I think, just impossible for a Russian citizen to publish whatever here. Maybe very, very late 80s, something started changing. I don't remember really because I keep all the magazines with my publications, but I would say it was late 80s, beginning of 90s, something like that.
You were here, I think, the last time. You've been here a couple of times, but you were here the last time to talk about The Slinks. Is this your only novel?
Yes.
Why? I mean, are you just so comfortable in the short story form?
No, it's just because it takes me a long, long time to write something. And I write, even if I have to write two pages, it just takes me years because I'm a perfectionist, but it's more than that. You know, I see what is to be written in this or that piece, and I cannot, you know, and so I still see it. And so I try again and again and again until I am... well, more or less satisfied. Imagine if it's so difficult for me to write two pages, then what about a novel? So it took me years to write this novel and to make all these things move. And I would like to write another novel. Now it became easier for me, but still, because just to write a book, it's so easy. I can sit down and write endlessly, but I don't do that. I somehow have to conceive and then give birth. I'm sorry.
Well, what about conceiving of the plot of The Slinks, which takes place in a Russian city that had once been called Moscow 20 years before, but then there's...
200 years.
200 years,
yeah.
I meant. Then there's this blast, which we assume was a nuclear explosion, and survivors now live in extremely primitive circumstances. Was that some kind of a metaphor for the end of the Soviet Union?
No, because I started writing it in 1986.
Well, that was the beginning of the end, wasn't it?
Well, that was the beginning of the end, but...
Could this have happened if it had you'd been living in New York? Could it just have been New York 200 years after the blast?
Well, I don't know. Maybe, because I know that many, at least movie makers, just play with this idea that there will be a final blast and then everything will go to dogs, you know. The thing is that the very fact that in Russia the country collapses from time to time and then the same thing is brought back, but on a different level, on a lower level, of course. I think the idea was with me for a long time, and it disturbed me. And then when when the Soviet Union started collapsing, which was a very pleasant thing to happen for me. I couldn't believe my eyes and ears. But at that time, I already, I think, foresaw what may happen when this thing collapses again. And, well, it is sad because everything disappears, everything is destroyed, culture disappears, and people lose any idea of what it used to be. People don't have any memories.
Well, you observed most of the worst years of the collapse of the Soviet Union from the United States, didn't you? You were teaching in Princeton and Skidmore.
Yes.
So when you went back?
I went back about once a year, at least.
And were you able to catch up each time?
With difficulty, because, of course, I didn't belong to that life. And I, compared to others whom I knew, I was extremely, extremely rich, I would say. Though I was a very humble teacher of certain things in humanities, and I never had enough money here, so I had to, you know, to write and to read lectures and so on. But for Russians there, I was extremely, extremely rich. Now, let me just give you one example. In these years, my mother wanted to repair our apartment. We had a huge apartment, 4 rooms, 2 floors. It was a luxury apartment, once used to be. And she wanted just to, you know, to paint the walls, to replace the tiles, to repair the ceiling, because it hasn't been done for, let's say, 10 years. And she asked me to help with money, because it took some money to do that. Do you know how much it costed in American dollars? $50. $50 to repair the whole thing. That's the difference in prices.
Now Moscow is one of the most expensive cities in the world.
Yes. Now you cannot buy an apartment in Moscow or in St. Petersburg. I don't know who are these people that can buy the apartment. 3-4 years ago, it was still possible. Now, no.
What about some of the other disturbing things we're seeing, the crackdown on dissidents, even though there aren't a heck of a lot of them, and the sense of a growing move toward authoritarianism? Do you see this as another one of those periods of transition into something?
Well, we definitely have a period of transition, because next year, $2,000, my. I'm used to 19-something. 2008.
We'll have an election, too.
We'll have a presidential election. And so everyone is discussing every day, at least in newspapers over the web, will Putin remain or what?
Well, he said he's not running, but that doesn't mean that he won't remain the power behind whoever wins.
It means
wins.
Nothing. It means absolutely nothing. I believe that he doesn't want to remain. I believe that. Because from the very beginning, he didn't want to be a president. Well, then, of course, he enjoyed some benefits of being a president, but he's tired. And he would like to have some private life, a good private life, somewhere else. But it's not possible. It's not possible.
Life has been dangerous for some people who write about politics in Russia these days. We've seen any number of journalists killed. Do you ever worry about crossing over a line?
No, it's only you.
Because you've written any number of essays on politics.
No, it has nothing to do with real danger. Those who are dangerous for the authorities, they either touch some personalities in a harsh way, or some people who, let's say, I don't know how to say it. It's even money that becomes endangered, or some reputation on a very high person, person at the very top, and the person sees through these publications that they really know something about him, mm-hmm. because everyone is cursing everyone else, and it's absolutely not dangerous. But if someone, you cannot say, we as readers, we cannot say whether it's the truth or it's just as we call PR, public relations. But if it is truth, then the one knows about it, the person who who is discussed, and then he may strike back. That's what is going on. And you never know who is more dangerous than others. It's not that direct. You know, here when I read some articles from the Western press, I see that the media presents the situation as if it were a simple pyramid. Putin on the top, then some horrible people surrounding him, then a wider ring of people. No, this is not it. It's much more complicated, much more dangerous, and Putin is not the worst of those who rule us. No.
The New York Review of Books has been reprinting works of real merit, works that unfortunately have fallen out of print. And that has led them to put together a collection of short stories by Tatiana Tolstoya called White Walls, and to reissue her novel, The Slinks, in paperback. And it has been my great pleasure to have Tatiana Tolstoya as a guest today on my show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.